I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. Dale Jamieson, professor of environmental studies and philosophy at New York University, writes, "If there is to be a meaningful change that makes a difference over the long term, it must be both collective and thoroughgoing. Developing a deeper understanding of who we are, as well as how our best conceptions of ourselves can guide change, is the fundamental issue that we face. The problem we face is not a purely scientific problem that can be solved by the accumulation of scientific information. Science has alerted us to the problem, but the problem also concerns our values. It is about how we ought to live and how humans should relate to each other and to the rest of nature. These are problems of ethics and politics as well as problems of science." On Prof Talk today, you will hear the voice of Sonia Klinsky, a young and inspiring doctoral student from the UBC Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability. She talks about her thesis titled, "Across Years, Lands and Oceans, Justice and Scale in Climate Change Policy Decision Making." You are listening to Prof Talk. Sonia Klinsky's current research builds on several traditions to focus on justice and climate change. Part of this explores the use of justice principles in international policy, while part of it attempts to better understand public conceptualizations of justice in the climate context. Sonia and I began our discussion at the CITR studio. Thank you, Sonia, for coming in today, and welcome to the show. Sonia, your current research focuses on justice and climate change. I thought I would first start by asking you, how is justice and climate change intrinsically linked, and how can the public better conceptualize global warming in the context of discussions about justice?
All right, well, I'm going to divide that kind of into two parts and deal with the first one and then deal with the second one. So if I forget to get to the second one, just remind me. Justice and climate change, I think, are inextricably linked in several ways. The first is that those of us who benefit the most from fossil energy are likely not the ones who are going to face the worst costs. So you can look at that from a future generations perspective. So those of us living today are driving our cars and have a high energy intensive lifestyle, and we're not the ones who are going to be alive 100 years from now or 150 years from now when some of the worst impacts of climate change start to happen. So already there you have a difference between those who are benefiting and those who are affected, which is a justice question, right? Because you have an unequal distribution of the costs and benefits. So there's one aspect of it. Another aspect you can look at is in terms of the actual burden of climate policy. So there may be certain kinds of policies which will actually generate money. But right now, a lot of them are costing money. So it's costing money to do different kinds of energy production. It's costing energy to put in place different adaptations, whether that be a seawall or resettlement or changing agricultural patterns. Those all right now, because we haven't developed the technologies, are all expensive. So then you have another question. Who is going to pay for this and who's going to benefit from it? So should the people who are going to benefit directly be paying for it, although they maybe didn't cause the problem of climate change in the first place? What about non-human species who are going to be impacted and yet really did nothing to cause the problem? So any situation like this where you have a large difference in people in terms of costs, benefits, and causation, and I don't want to use the word victimization, but people who are bearing impacts, you have an intrinsic justice problem. And climate change is a particularly nasty one because it splits across income. So those who are very wealthy often have the resources to take care of themselves, to relocate, to develop another way of life, to their more mobility. And they're also the ones who are benefiting the most. Those who don't have the resources are the ones who are going to be impacted and have the fewest resources to adapt. So you have that kind of thing. You also have distance across actual physical distance. and a distance across time, and social distance in terms of distance across species. So you have, there's a very famous sort of philosopher who works in this named Stephen Gardner, and he calls it the perfect moral storm, because no matter how you look at it, you have these very deep justice questions. So this is, those are some of the things why I think the two are, you can't really separate them, because both the actual thing itself, the thing being climate change, and how we deal with it, which is climate policy, also has implicit justice elements to it, because it's going to be expensive. So that's the first part. The second part, in terms of how I think this might help the public, there's been a fair amount of research in terms of how the public understands the science of climate change. You'll probably remember all the huge debates, which are still raging, actually, in some parts, of, you know, who caused it? Is it real? Is it really happening? How do we understand this complex science when the modelers themselves are kind of a little bit confused sometimes? But there's been very little work in terms of how people understand their obligations to others in the climate context. So everyone understands fairness. I mean, everyone who has a child or anyone who has a work colleague has problems with fairness, right? You have conflicts. You're dividing a chocolate bar among three kids, or you're dealing with four colleagues who need the same space at the same time. We have an implicit and daily interaction with fairness, and people get it. People often get really upset about fairness. You'll see someone almost yelling. How many times have you heard a small kid like, "That's not fair," like screaming, right? It's a really basic part of who we are. And I think that in all the climate debates, we get so caught up on the numbers and all the technical aspects. People need to know, well, how many thousands of millions of tons of carbon dioxide are being produced? Well, the average person doesn't really have any sense. And why should they, of what a ton of carbon dioxide is? I study this. I don't really know what a ton of carbon dioxide looks like. I've never seen it. So how do I imagine this? It's impossible, right? But I can imagine what's fair. I can have a sense of, well, you know, maybe this person caused the problem, or maybe this person really needs help. It's a little more human. It reminds me of who we're actually dealing with. And so I think bringing some of this to the public discussion enables the public, or could enable, it hasn't been done yet, so it could enable the public to engage in a way that's more useful, as opposed to trying to become expert scientists in a field that even the experts are constantly struggling with. So I think what's useful with this with the public is we all have a sense of fairness. We all have a right to have our opinions about what's fair and what's right heard. And this is a place where we can bring this into the public discussion in a more useful way than the scientific debates have been done. Not that we should ignore the scientific debates, but this is an add-on to it.
So how do you visualize that happening, especially in context of bearing, us bearing impacts of climate change, what you said in your first point, how can that knowledge be disseminated to the public in a way that they can really understand climate change through the sort of perspective of justice and fairness?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, my research right now, as far as I know, there's been so little work on the justice element of it. And the work that has come, there's been a core group of philosophers who are really wonderful people, and they've put a lot of thought into this, but public outreach isn't really their forte. So it's been a very ivory tower discussion. And there's been a lot of writing on it. It started in the mid-90s, but it hasn't really gotten further than that. And so I think that there's a couple of ways we could go with this. There are several projects like the Climate Justice Project happening right now. It's actually a proposal in the stage of hopefully becoming a project. It's being headed up by the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. And it's a really wonderful group, because what they've done is they have a huge arrangement of NGOs, academics, just a really wide range of people. And that's a great way of getting it out, because now you have people who are working for a union saying, hey, maybe we should think about the justice aspects of this. Or you have people who are working with low-income housing going, maybe, how does this relate to climate change? Are there going to be links here? How can we think about this? So I think that's a really positive step. So I don't see this as a massive campaign, because they've tried a lot of climate campaigns and people don't listen to campaigns and they're already overwhelmed and they're already worried, and trying to get people engaged in this is really going to be hard. But I think that kind of process where you're looking with organizations which are already working with people with some of the issues, because the great thing and the challenging thing about climate change is that it's amorphous. It changes shape. It changes its face. So for some communities, the impacts are going to be something like sea level rise, which is probably going to be an issue in Richmond or Delta, where we have very flat communities on mud or sand. They already have issues with flooding. They already have some issues with dikes. And as we saw the Seawell breach a couple years in Delta, this is going to become a bigger issue. So working at that level where people are already talking about it. So I know the mayor in Delta is already talking about, people there are already starting to say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? So I think finding where the conversations are already happening and just building on top of them instead of trying to push through a whole new agenda of campaigning and getting people aware of the issue. I think you just add on to what's already happening and maybe it'll happen or maybe not. It could be really optimistic.
Now, you've already touched a little bit about philosophy, how you draw on philosophy in your work. But you also, in your research, you raise questions of justice across other skills of understanding climate change. And so policy analysis is one of those, as well as psychology. Can you give us some examples of how you connect these areas of our current understanding of climate change?
Sure, absolutely. Like as I have alluded to already, philosophy has been a bit of a base for this, which is ironic. I'm not a philosopher. I have no idea what I'm doing. I've been very lucky to find philosophers who have helped me along and who've written very lovely works, which have helped me enormously. It's not my area of expertise, and I don't pretend to be a philosopher. At the same time, I've been very lucky in that two of my main supervisors have a great deal of experience in the policy community, and they have been wonderfully supportive in helping me get a grasp of that literature and how people are approaching it. And the psychology has been one that I stumbled onto totally by accident and which has been essential. When I started this work, I think the paper you read was very much not involving psychology. It was looking mostly at some philosophy stuff and some policy analysis stuff. And one of the things that came out of that work was there were a lot of large grandiose statements about, well, the public will never accept this because it's not fair, or we could never do this because the public won't go there. But I realized there was no research on what the public actually thought. We have lots of research, as I mentioned before, about the public thinks about the science, but we actually have no idea what the public thinks about justice. We have very little research about what the public thinks about obligations to others across large amounts of space. So I started looking in the psychology literature, and I found a very rich literature, around, especially in social psychology, around justice and the psychology of justice and how people decide what is and is not fair in any given context. And so this is what has shaped the second part of my work. It sort of adds on to the earlier interest in sort of the philosophy and policy analyst stuff into trying to understand how do people decide what's fair anyway. And so I guess what's been interesting there is in the social psychology research, a couple of sort of big themes emerge. One is the importance of how you understand the social context in which you are working. So any one person might say, let's say they're in a family and they have three kids and they're trying to decide what's fair amongst their three kids. They might use a principle of need. So who needs this the most? Which of my three kids really needs this and which will benefit the most? That'd be a very different discussion of how to decide what's fair if that same person were then possibly buying stocks and had put in $3,000 and then let's say they sold the company, they would probably want out in the same proportion that they had put in. So if they put in $1,000 and someone else put in $100, they would want about 10 times as much. Totally different discussion of what was fair than they had with their three kids. So in one situation, they're talking about need and the ability to use the resources. In another, you're talking about a strict proportion. I put in X amount, I want out Y amount. So this is complicating the issue now. So what we have are several scripts that people use to decide what is and is not fair. So what I think is really important is how do people understand the climate change? Which script do they think is important in the climate change one? Is the relevant script one about need or one about who can use our resources the best? Or is it about strict causation? Or is it about, well, we're funding this, so we should benefit the most? What theme is the most important? And so this is where the psychology work comes in. And my research uses some psychological techniques to explore this in more depth with people. One of the challenges with climate change is because it is a fairly abstract concept about which few people have direct experience, it can be very difficult to ask people about it sometimes. So if I just walked up to you in the street and said, hey, you know, what do you think about fairness and climate change? You would probably look at me like I was a little strange and probably wouldn't have a very good response. So that's where I use a lot of the psychology research, because psychology is quite, their whole discipline is based on trying to understand the next layer down. So you use techniques like I'm using with very structured decisions or very structured dilemmas where you can get at stuff you couldn't get at from just asking people straight up because people wouldn't have thought about it enough to give you a good answer. So that was a very long answer, but that's where the psychology comes in. So the first part of my research was a mix of psychology and philosophy. Second part of my research, trying to figure out how the public thinks about it, brings in both psychological techniques in terms of how we ask them, and also psychological concepts in terms of understanding the flexibility of people's sense of justice across different contexts. So part of this problem has to be to understand how people see the context so that then we can figure out how they're applying concepts of justice to it. Does that sort of make sense?
Now, do you, because you said that you don't have a background in philosophy and psychology, so how at the PhD level, how do you gain a lot of those skills to mm-hmm. understand, you know, the terminology or just understanding the sort of the systems that, say, a psychologist would use and put them in the framework of climate change? I can imagine that must be challenging.
Yes, it is quite challenging. How do you do it? Panic. You ask a lot of people, you make a lot of phone calls, you visit a lot of people in their offices and say, okay, I don't know what I'm doing. Can you help me here? And I've found that if you come to people with a really open arms and say what you know and say what you want to learn, people are usually remarkably willing to either send you a few key references or let you sit on a class or talk to you some more or read your work and critique it. I've been incredibly lucky in terms of finding people who say, okay, yeah, you don't know anything, but you seem like you're learnable and you can teach, you seem like you're interested in this area, so we'll spend some time with you. So that's, I think that's been the number one thing, is just talking to people and being aware and being very open with what I do know, but really what I don't know. And I think from my experience, people who are interested in teaching are delighted to find someone who's clearly doesn't know what they're doing, but has lots of enthusiasm. So that's part of it. I think the other big challenge is I am an interdisciplinary scholar, and this is an issue that comes up. Many of my PhD colleagues, are also in interdisciplinary studies or in fields which are bringing together things that have never been brought together that way, or in ways that the traditional disciplines didn't envision. And it's the kind of thing that keeps you up at night, because you imagine going to your defense and having someone who really is a full-time psychologist or philosopher saying, you can't say that. You know, so-and-so in 1837 proved that that was wrong. Didn't you read that paper? And you're kind of going, no, actually, I didn't read that paper. So it's a fear. It's a constant struggle. You try to do your best. You try to be open. You try to be clear about your limitations. And you just go with it. And you hope that you're learning enough. It's a constant feeling that you're not learning enough fast enough. And you just hope that the people around you are honest when they tell you that, yeah, you've got it. And that they will pull you up and say, no, you need to read this other stuff again because you're missing the point. And so far, I've been lucky. I found people who've done that. Hopefully, cross my fingers.
Right. Now, I'd like to talk about your current thesis. Maybe you can let us know what stage you are at your thesis, because a thesis can take a number of, as far as I've heard from many doctoral students, can change into a number of different forms as it progresses. But your title really intrigued me, Across Years, Lands and Oceans, Justice and Scale in Climate Change Policy Decision Making. I really like that title, and I was wondering maybe if you could sort of bring the first part of that title into context of where you're heading with your research.
Yeah, absolutely. As I alluded in the very beginning, the justice dilemmas in climate change are many. There's no shortage of them. I was sort of joking with my brother. He's like, well, at least you've got a sustainable area to study, because the problems will never go away. And I was like, it's true. It's I have lots of areas to work with. I guess Across Land, Years and Oceans, the years refers to the question where I was talking to earlier about this intergenerational tension we have. Here we are in our current lives trying to make decisions that are going to impact not only our children, not only our grandchildren, but their descendants, and more complicatedly, descendants of people in other parts of the world's children as well. So you're trying to understand and make decisions for context you have no idea what they're going to look like. I mean, think about how much the world has changed in the last 100 years. That's only a couple generations away, and we're trying to project what's right and what's appropriate across way longer than that. That's a very complicated thing to do. I mean, it's simple to say, but when you actually think about how hard it is to predict what people are going to need and want at the rate of change we've seen, and if you project, you know, it's not inconceivable that we'll have at least that amount of change in the next 100 years. That's a pretty complicated thing to be doing. So that's across the years. So we have to think about justice across the years, but years also indicates there's going to be big changes in what that actually looks like. We're not going to be it's not just, we can't just pretend that we're going to see Vancouver as it is right now in 200 years time. It's going to look completely different. We need to know that. So that's the year's tension. So we need to make that kind of decision. Across lands and oceans, one of the big challenges of climate change is that it doesn't look the same everywhere. In one area, it's going to be a drought. In another area, it's going to be a flood. How do you reconcile those things? How do you say, well, you know, person X in country Y, you're not as bad off as these other people because you have a drought, but at least you didn't get flooded out of your home. How do you compare these things? You have totally incomparable, non-commensurable impacts, and somehow you have to reconcile them in terms of prioritizing them, in terms of who should get funding, in terms of who should get attention. That's a very complicated thing to do because climate change is so disparate and does have 1,000 faces. And depending on where you are and who you are, it's going to look very different from how it looks to somebody else. And I guess the oceans one, again, is reminding us that we may, as humans, have obligations to people we don't see. It's entirely possible that me sitting here in Vancouver has obligations to someone in one of the Sea Island states, which is going to disappear. So how do we reconcile our sense of obligation that way? And our political system isn't set up terribly well for that. I mean, we can see that people might have obligations to someone in their own community. Perhaps we in Vancouver have obligations to the community of Delta, that we will help them build seawalls. Or maybe Richmond, because we have an airport there that could be at risk. Perhaps we all in Vancouver have some obligations to say, well, you know, we don't live in Richmond and we don't live in the airport, but we have some obligations to them because we benefit from it and it's part of our local community and we know them and we have special relationships with them. So maybe we need to take care of them. And maybe in the Canadian Arctic, we have some obligations too, because it's part of Canada. We're all Canadians. You know, are we going to let people in the north suffer while us in the south are relatively safe? It seems problematic. But then where do you draw the boundary? So do we have obligations across oceans? Do we have obligations to everybody? And if so, how do they compare with the obligations we feel here? So that's what the first part of that title was trying to get at, is this sense of multiple contexts and multiple kinds of distance across which we need to think about justice. Time, space, differential experience. We need to think about all those things when we're thinking about justice. And that's what really feeds into the second part of the title, which is the sense of justice and scale. And so that's the bulk of the second part of my research. The first part was sort of these big questions of philosophy and how are we going to fit it all together? And the second one was much smaller in terms of how do we balance different scales? So how do we balance our obligations towards Delta with our obligations towards Tuktoyaktuk in the north, with our obligations towards large parts of Bangladesh, with our obligations towards other countries? So where do we set the bounds and how do we understand these scales at which climate change is going to operate? And that's what the second part of the title kind of refers to.
Do you have any personal goals with completing this research?
Well, finishing would be good.
That's a very practical answer.
A very nice thing to be done. It feels very far away. The closer I get, the further it feels. So that would be a good thing. That would be a really good thing. Personal goals, I guess I ended up doing this because I realized it was totally by accident. I came here to do research on how people understood climate change from a very scientific perspective. I wanted to track documents and figure out how different people use them. And then I realized really at the heart of this was that what concerns me most about climate change is it does feel like a huge injustice. And as someone who really has always hoped that my work ultimately, no matter what it would be, would contribute to working towards justice, it's felt like it was the right time and the place to be doing it in this way. Do I think it's going to go anywhere? Probably not. It's a PhD thesis. PhD theses don't usually go anywhere directly. I hope it'll help me develop a lot of skills so that hopefully I can contribute to these debates in a more concrete way. I don't have any I have to be realistic. This is rare that a PhD thesis really does contribute to social change in any meaningful way. So I don't want to be totally naive and optimistic. But I do hope that it gives me the tools to contribute more effectively in policy debates and in public discussions around this issue, because I do think that's where we have to go next. We have to get this out in the public more. We have to start demanding that questions of ethics and justice be included in the technical and economic aspects of climate change, because they are equally important. Science is essential. Science can tell us so much. It's essential in this debate. We can't demean the importance of science, but it cannot tell us what to value. That is an ethical question. Each one of us has to decide what is important, what are we going to sacrifice, how are we going to make these trade-offs, and they're really hard questions. And that's where ethics and questions of justice come in. And so I really feel passionately that this has to be included in the discourse.
Thank you so much for sharing your research with us. And I really wish you the best of luck in your the completion of your thesis. And I think you need to be out in the media getting this this information out.
Well,
so
let's see what happens. Thanks for your luck. Yeah. I need all the luck I can get right now. It feels really big.
Yeah. That was doctoral student Sonia Klinsky from the UBC Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability.
None of us are free. One of us are chained. None of us are free. And there are people still in darkness, and they just can't see the light. If you don't say it's wrong, then that says it's right. We got to try to feel for each other. Let our brothers know that we care. Got to get the message, send it out loud and clear. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. One of us are chained. None of us are free. Now I swear, your salvation isn't too hard to find. None of us can find it on our own. We've got to join together in spirit, heart, and mind, so that every soul suffering will know that we're not alone. Cause the world is getting smaller each passing day.
Passing day.
And now it's time to start making changes. And it's time for us all to realize that the truth is shining bright right before our eyes.
This is Prof Talk on UBC's CITR 101.9 FM on the Point Grey campus in Vancouver. If you would like to send us feedback of this show, please email us at proftalk@gmail.com. Or for an updated schedule, visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also listen to the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS RentsLine can help. AMS RentsLine is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.